Al Kidder.
As I say, I was a picket line captain. I was the captain of the pickets. I set up schedules. I ran the pickets around the store. I was there probably for the better part of 2 days during the mass picketing, trying to keep some semblance of order and trying to keep a picket line going, which was basically ridiculous because you didn't need a picket line with all those people there.
Well, there was a regular picket line along with the crowd of people.
Yeah, we had our regular picket schedule set up, and the people were still picketing.
Anybody try to go through?
Very, very few. Very few. In fact, I think the doors were locked the biggest part of the time, if I recall correctly. But, you know, you just don't let something like that go. You try to keep a semblance of order by saying, okay, we keep our picket line going. We don't know what's going to happen. Because this was something that nobody expected. Of course, being a neophyte into the labor movement, I felt that that was a normal procedure, that this would happen all the time. I didn't think anything different about it. Now, boy, these guys are strong.
The first night of the general strike, a mass meeting was held at the Oakland Auditorium. 10,000 rank-and-file union members piled into the hall to hear what the labor leaders had to say, while 5,000 more stood outside in the pouring rain, listening to the meeting over a hastily set up loudspeaker. Al Kidder was there.
Yeah, I think the feeling there was completely behind the general strike and behind the effort that was being put forth. I think they had probably one of the finest show of solidarity that the labor movement could ask for. But there again, as I say, it's something you can't plan. It's something that happens. And it was. It was a solid group of people there that were... They weren't out there to say, let's get this over with or knock off this foolishness. It was, let's get this thing squared away and let's get these people to understand that we're here and we're going to be here and we're going to be out until it does happen.
Reservations on the part of any of the union leaders about the general strike?
Oh, some.
Joe Chaudet.
Some. Some of the Teamsters, there were a couple of the Teamsters, were a little, it began to bubble up over the neck. And some of them were a little timid about it. But I was told it was a telegram from Tobin, from the Teamsters, and Dave Beck, who was on his way up as heir apparent to Dan Tobin, to get back to work and knock off this stuff. And they all those Picard that were making all the money, they tried to get into the act, and they were all in, you know. They were appalled at the thought of their people going out on strike on, you know, a simple measure like strike breaking and having your people driven off the streets.
Joe Chaudet.
Number one, when I talk about Dave Beck, who are you talking about? You're talking about a man that made millions, went to prison and everything else. He never really represented this union. I mean, the way it should be represented. Here they were, the greatest organization of people, and Beck was I think that some of the retail merchants associations got a hold of Beck, and then he started putting the juice on him. And then Charlie Real, who was head of the Teamsters, was in direct communication. Number one, he was a Republican. And he was in their pocket. And so he wired home that he'd come home and settle it for $10,000 or $15,000, I forget which. He was finally thrown out of the Teamsters union for stealing so much money.
What else led to the end of the general strike?
It was a question, too, of the Downtown Merchants Association. Mr. Nolan and the people down at the courthouse realizing, well, look, you know, we got a bear by the tail. What the hell do we do? And so we had several meetings. We met up the Athens Club two or three times. And finally, it just came down to the point that I think it runs its course. But like anything else, general strike picked Peters out after a few days. You know, what are you going to do? They start doing like that. Everyone started. The one in San Francisco started the shooting of two people. This one started over knocking us off the streets. One or two around the country started with the killing of a person or something like this. And this is the way they all start. But Who knows how to run a general strike? I've never seen a formula or a book or anything that can tell exactly how you run a general strike. It happens, boom, and that's it. And then all of a sudden it peters out, period. It runs its course. However, this is one of the things between Bob Ash and I that we disagreed to until the day, the last night of the settlement. The CIO notified us that if it went past Thursday, that they'd shut off lights and power. And I wanted to continue one more day and shut off the lights and power. And then we'd have had the whole ball of wax. And Bob Ash, he prevailed, and Galliano prevailed. And we went back to work, I think, on Thursday morning. Friday morning, whatever the day was. Bob Ash and I still disagree to this day. Now he says, Joe, you were right. He says, we'd have had it all. Because that would have been a general strike. You know, that would have been a general strike. I think all Nolan, the minute all the lights went out, the Oakland Tribune would have been over there. I don't think he even had to pick up. He'd pick up the phone and call him and says, you're no longer a city council. And we'd have turned the city completely around. I think we'd have had every resignation up there of all of the stupid city council. We had the faceless men. We'd have had it. And then we would have been able to sit down and say, well, this is what we want. There's five resignations up there. There's seven resignations, whatever we want. We'll take one or two, or we'll take this, say. And this is when I think that we'd have made some good, solid gains as far as the labor movement was concerned. But once we lost that position, you know, of not being in a general strike, you know, how do you capture it again?
What did it feel like once the strike was over?
It was just a question, well, look, we've shown them, you know, without getting everything, all of the little points down in writing, we've shown them we did it, you know, and we're satisfied with it.
Did unions get a firm commitment from the city that the police wouldn't be used to aid strike breaking?
Yes. It was not a firm commitment, but this was one of the understandings that they wouldn't be used to, you know, to break strike, which, you know, they didn't sign anything, but the next day, if they'd had to use the police, they'd have done it, so they weren't kidding anybody.
At 11 a.m., Thursday, December 5th, 1946, the general strike officially came to an end. But the workers at the two department stores were still out on strike, as Al Kidder explains.
We were still on picket on strike. We were still picketing. We just kept right on going until finally, after the first of the year, when the interim agreement was finally reached with the Retail Merchants Association and Conn's and Hastings. And as far for all practical purposes, it was strictly nothing. As far as the union contract, it didn't give union security. It didn't give us anything, really. And we weren't able to get a contract into there until 1954. We went back and started organizing again.
The final settlement of the Conn's-Hastings labor dispute didn't come till several years later.
Excerpts from a KPFA documentary on the 1946 Oakland General Strike. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Let's turn to the end of the documentary.
Another aspect of the outcome of the strike was the city council elections of May 1947. Labor organized a slate of candidates to oppose the incumbents. The CIO unions were particularly active in the Alameda County AFL-CIO political coalition. The unions, aligned with the Oakland Voters League, an independent organization, supported a platform of progressive policies. These included a restructuring of the city tax system, government neutrality during strikes, rent control, and an overhaul of the public health services. Also supported by the Negro Labor Committee, four of the five labor-backed candidates were elected. The fifth, Ben Goldfarb, probably lost due to anti-Semitism and a misleading layout of the ballot, which made his opponent appear as part of the labor slate.
This showed the temper of the people of the city of Oakland when they threw out those faceless men.
Joe Chaudet.
They realized what had been done to their city. we carried on a campaign, and it was a good campaign, a solid campaign. We had people out working, pushing doorbells, but we did a job, which showed the temper of the people of the city of Oakland. They realized that the labor movement was right, because they supported us. Whoever won before in Oakland, all Mr. Nolan had to do was push a button, and he could elect any faceless man that he wanted to.
What would you say then the general strike and the resulting political activity did for labor unity in Oakland?
I think it was one of the greatest things that ever happened. It gave the whole labor movement, Craig, an impetus. We showed what could be done in two successive years. We showed by the general strike, if you hang together, you can take anybody on. And by the election, we came that close, you know. If we'd had a guy by the name of O'Brien, we'd have run it all.
Dan Bro.
For quite a period of time, there was a labor unity that was hard to penetrate after the general strike. Like most things, time developed an apathy, and there has been general chewing on one another. The Teamsters pulled out of the AFL-CIO, of course. Teamsters, under one administration, went on a pirating binge where they were trying to take over other jurisdictions. Situation developed where other unions were doing the same thing.
The Teamsters, there's some parallels between, you know, their activity in 1946 and activity today still.
It comes right from the top on down. It's just that simple. You had a militant labor movement in the 40s. It was actually, I think, a carryover from the 30s when you had wrinkles in your belly and the chow lines and general degrading situation of the Great Depression. And things, of course, picked up a little bit in the war years. So they no longer had the wrinkles in their bellies, but they still had the militancy that had been developed in the 30s.
Joe Chaudet.
They don't remember what we went through in the 30s to get that. Striking and getting the hell kicked out of us in some respects. And going to bat because we knew that eventually it would pay off for us. Possibly it was selfish in those days, but it, nevertheless, it was a fight.
It's not as it is today where they've had things soft for a long time, and there's an apathy, at least in my opinion, growing among the rank and file union member, because they think that this situation that they're enjoying was brought on by altruism on the part of the employers. And we who went through the Depression and went through the general strike and have fought for the rank-and-file member for a lifetime, we know better that there's no altruistic or benevolent employer. He'll take every ounce of blood that he can get out of you and then tie a can to you when you have outlived your usefulness. Even the better employers are that same way, to perhaps a lesser degree than the heartless giant corporations.
Do you think the idea of a general strike seems a lot more out of place today, a lot more unlikely than it was back in 46, right after the war?
No, I think a general strike could happen today just as easy as it did then.
Al Kidder.
What you have to do is to find the spark that creates the condition that would cause a general strike to happen. And there is no way, I don't think, that anyone could go out today and say, well, now, if I wanted to call a general strike, this is what I'd do. Because a general strike is called on something that happens, and it's got to be a combination of everything coming together at the right moment to create that one little condition that says, here it is, it happens. I don't think you could plan it and have it come off effectively.
What kind of effect do you think that the general strike had on people's minds?
I think it gave the working people, the people in unions, an indication of their strength that they had if they stood together. I don't think it may have had a bearing as far as the labor legislation that came in at that time. The Taft-Hartley, it could have had an input into that, because the Taft-Hartley most certainly did put a curtailment on us as far as some of our activities, some of our abilities to organize, put restrictions there that we hadn't had before. But when you say what did it do for people, I think it gave them a greater sense of power to just, in other words, what can we do as union people? What can being in a union do for you? I think it had an impact for a while, but memories are short, people forget. And it's like today in the younger generation, which I don't blame them a bit, I was the same way, that say, hey, look, don't remind me what happened in the past, what's gonna go on today?
Many factors contributed to the general strike being an inconclusive skirmish over control of the city. The quieting of the labor front nationally, new prosperity, and the Cold War ideology added to the fact of a progressive militant trade union leadership that had nowhere else to go. This is the anniversary of the Oakland General Strike, but there is no monument to the working men and women who struck for the right to organize in 1946. No doubt that there are those who would like working people to forget that strike, and also forget that even today, that power remains in the hands of a potentially united, if presently unmilitant, working class.
And that was a radio documentary produced here at KPFA on the Oakland General Strike, which we're marking 65 years on. It was just a month ago that we marked the 65th anniversary of the Oakland General Strike, and the documentary history was made on the 30th anniversary, which is in 1976, by Craig Gordon, Ed Schoenfield, Ken Russell, Vic Rubin, and Tim Reagan, and it was narrated by Ed Schoenfield. The program has been Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.